That's the men's Final Four. It's also Final Four weekend in women's college basketball. Their semifinals tip off this evening in Indianapolis, and that is where we find NPR's Tom Goldman. Hi, Tom.
Hi, David.
We're talking a lot about Connecticut this weekend. They're in the women's Final Four as well.
Yes, they are. They certainly are. They're playing Notre Dame tonight.
And they already have two straight titles under their belt. This could be number three. I guess they're the odds-on favorite?
Well, not with everyone. They are certainly one of the favorites, but they don't have the dominance and the ability to intimidate that past UConn women's teams have had. And even their coach acknowledged that, Gino Auriemma. And Notre Dame is certainly aware of that, even though Notre Dame has lost three times this year to the Huskies. In the plus column for UConn, they do have Maya Moore. She's the best player in the country. She dominates games. They basically play a six-person rotation. That means a lot of minutes for those six players, but Gino Auriemma gets the most out of them, and a couple of freshmen, post players, Stephanie Dolson, point guard Bria Hartley, have been the big contributors too.
And what do you think the key is if Notre Dame is going to contain Maya Moore and have a chance?
Well, I think what you have to do, you got to play as good a defense as you can. The Irish have an outstanding point guard in Skylar Diggins, and she and forward Devereaux Peters, they could keep Notre Dame close for a while, David. But this really should be the fourth UConn win over Notre Dame this year.
And on the other side, we have Texas A&M facing Stanford, and I know Stanford is known for a pretty high-flying offense. I mean, can the Aggies keep up? Do they have a defense that can keep up with them?
Yeah, well, their defense is what they're all about. If their defense plays the way it usually does, you know, they could make this close and maybe even pull off the upset. The Aggies are this scrappy, defensive-minded team. In the tournament, they've held opponents to less than 45 points a game. Their defense is keyed by their guards, the Sydneys, senior Sydney Colson and junior Sydney Carter, and they've been great at shutting down opposing guards. And that's why the Stanford senior point guard Jeanette Polin is one of the keys today. Point guards start the offense. They drive the team, and Stanford has this dominant front line with the Agwumike sisters, Shanae and Nneka, but they need Polin to direct the offense to them, and they need Polin to hit her long-range outside shots as well. And for her to do that, she's got to handle the defensive pressure from those Sydneys.
We have some perennial powerhouses in the women's side, Tennessee, Baylor, both out. What's that done to the tournament? I mean, more competitive, more open?
You know, the fear, David, among those who want the women's game to keep growing in popularity is that this may make it less competitive. You know, there's just not the widespread talent in the women's game that there is in men's. Most of your top-rated high school female players end up going to a handful of premier college programs, and that's why many expected and hoped that this Final Four was going to be the four number one seeds. It was believed that would give us the best basketball in Indianapolis. But as we've talked about, Texas A&M, Notre Dame, they're number two seeds. They're no slouches. And they could, make for some potentially good games tonight.
It's NPR's Tom Goldman reporting on the Women's Final Four, which kicks off tonight in Indianapolis. Tom, enjoy the games.
Thanks, David.
Now let's meet a man named Richard Polsky. He was closing in on 50 when he decided it was time to chase his childhood dream. Sure, he was a successful art dealer and author, but what he really wanted to do was hunt for dinosaurs. And not just any dinosaur. The king, the beast, the Tyrannosaurus Rex. He set off for the Badlands of South Dakota. And in his new book, Boneheads, My Search for T-Rex, he talks about his fellow dinosaur hunters, the Boneheads.
Right. Actually, the title comes from a pair of T-Rex hunting twins, Stan and Steve Sackerson. There have been approximately 45 T-Rexes found in the history of the world. They're responsible for having found three of them, but they're characters. One sleeps in his car, the other's a gravedigger by day, and they're known in the trade as the Bonehead Brothers because they're goofballs. And, I had such a crazy time with them. Because the leader of the group was this guy, Bob Dietrich, who calls himself the Fossil King. And I didn't know who was crazier, these guys for coming up with this stuff or me for going along with it.
There's a passage in your book when you're describing chatting with one of them. I wonder if you could turn to page 148.
Sure.
You're meeting Steve, I think? He's one of the twins, the
yes,
crazy twins
the,
you were talking about?
One of the
about?
Bonehead Brothers.
Okay, yeah. Read that paragraph for me if you can.
Then Steve yawned. And his tobacco-stained teeth made me cringe. So did the words he spoke next. You think you've got what it takes to find a T-Rex? Well, let me tell you, it's not that easy. You're not going to find anything. You people come out here from parts unknown and think you can take our dinosaurs.
Is that what they call a warm welcome in the Badlands of South Dakota?
Well, you know, they had mixed feelings about seeing me. You got to understand, we're talking about commercial dinosaur hunters. These are not professors with PhDs at big universities. These are guys that survive by their wits. And in order to find dinosaurs, you have to go out on land that belongs to private ranchers. So the few paleontologists, that is to say the commercial diggers, who get permission, they sign contracts, they cut the ranchers in, they're not keen about giving you their secrets, letting you know their locations where the dinosaurs are.
Tell me about a day in the field. What's it like out there actually doing the digging? I mean, are you guys standing over a hole with shovels and chatting, or what exactly is going on?
Well, it's not what you think. A lot of people are confused about what these guys do because they all saw the movie Jurassic Park. Do you remember at the beginning of the movie, there's a scene where they're out in the field and Laura Dern, and I forgot the other guy, her paleontologist boyfriend, they're digging. They come across a perfectly articulated skeleton. They take what looks like a paintbrush and swipe away a little sand. And again, there's this beautiful dinosaur stretched out before them.
I suppose days are not usually that perfect out in the field
in real life. No, no. This is hard work. It's usually 90 degrees out during the summer. It's hot. You're perspiring. You're dirty. And it's just so rare that you see something that's worth taking back. So when they're out in the field, you waste a lot of time where you come across bone. Then you have to identify it. And if you decide, oh, it's just a fossil turtle shell or something like that, you move on. It's a real treasure hunt. It's like winning the lottery when you score a T-Rex.
You wrote in the book about the ups and downs, thinking you discovered things. In the end, you arguably were part of a discovery of part of a T-Rex. And actually, Richard Polsky, they named this T-Rex after you.
Well, again, this is partly true. Bob Dietrich did uncover something. I was with him when he uncovered it. And in the T-Rex world, when you find a dinosaur, you have the honor of naming it after anyone you want. And he wants to name this piece that he found, Little Richard.
After you.
After me.
Maybe you're going to be the more famous Little Richard someday.
one can only hope.
Well, did you find your dream?
Well, it was certainly a great adventure. It was a real window into the life and lifestyle of what these people do. So on that level, it was thrilling, and I felt really sad when I left these guys. And these guys were just so excited to be part of this. It was vindication that someone finally wrote about their side of things. Most books on dinosaurs are scientific. They're written by PhDs, and quite frankly, they're boring. This really told a story, told their story. And on that level, I was grateful I connected with them and ultimately did feel like I was part of it.
Richard Polsky is the author of the new book, Boneheads, My Search for T-Rex. Richard, enjoy your next hunt. Thank you for being here.
Thanks a lot.
You're listening to Weekend Edition from NPR News. You've probably seen those commercials for cruise ships with people on the back of the boat whacking golf balls out into the ocean. Or maybe you remember the Seinfeld episode when George Costanza, pretending to be a marine biologist, had to rescue an injured whale on the beach.
And I found myself right on top of him, face to face with the blowhole. I could barely see from the waves crashing down upon me, but I knew something was there. So I reached my hand in, felt around, and pulled out the obstruction.
And George was holding up the obstruction. It was a golf ball.
What is that, a Titleist?
A golf ball which we learned had been hit into the ocean by George's buddy, Kramer. Golf balls ending up in the wrong places can actually be a very serious problem, and we have an update today. Whales and other marine life, at least, can relax a little bit. There's a new kind of golf ball in town. It's a biodegradable golf ball that's made from lobster shells. We're joined now by David Nevant. He's a professor of biological and chemical engineering at the University of Maine in Orono, and he helped create this ball. Welcome to the program.
Thank you, David.
I understand you remember that Seinfeld episode.
Yeah, I do. It always amuses me when I think of that project. It's one of the first things that comes to mind is that Seinfeld episode.
We should say that biodegradable golf balls are not a brand new invention, but yours is the first made with lobster shells. Why lobster shells? Why is that the choice?
For us, it was a natural choice. You know, one of the major waste streams out of the lobster processing and, in fact, crustacean processing in general facilities is the crustacean shell, which is often landfilled or on occasion returned to the ocean.
What kind of a shelf life are we talking about? I mean, if these golf balls made from lobster shells end up on the ocean floor, how quickly do they biodegrade?
Degradation in the ocean is of the order of a week to 2 weeks, somewhere in that time frame.
So quickly?
Comparatively fast, that's right.
How long do regular golf balls last on the ocean floor?
There's been a study done, I believe it was out of Europe, that estimated degradation times in the order of 100 to 1,000 years.
A lot longer.
Very persistent.
And these lobster golf balls, they look like your average golf ball? I mean, it'll look familiar to people?
Yeah, we've designed them so that they're dimensionally the same as a regular golf ball. They weigh the same amount. They're dimpled like a regular golf ball to give them the correct flight characteristics.
Are you a golfer?
I'm a hacker.
Well, how far can a golfer drive a lobster shell golf ball compared to a regular old Titleist?
So using a driver, we're getting approximately 70% of the distance of a regular golf ball. So it's not quite as functional as a conventional golf ball.
So we might not see these on the PGA Tour, but people on cruise ships might be willing to take a little bit off their shot.
Well, that's our hope, exactly.
David Nevant, professor at the University of Maine and one of the creators of a golf ball made of lobster shells. Professor, thank you for being here.
Most welcome. Thanks for your interest in our project.
This is NPR News. The nation's unemployment rate fell slightly in March to 8.8%. More than 200,000 jobs were added to the payroll. But as NPR's Zoe Chase reports, there are a lot of people who weren't counted in the unemployment picture, and they're being shut out of the economic recovery.
Economist Bill Rogers has a name for this recovery, and it's not a very nice one.
The horrible recession combined with this weak recovery has led to this bifurcated set of outcomes.
The bifurcated recovery. That's what this story is about, where people who do have college degrees get hired and people who don't are sitting on the sidelines.
And when in doubt, let's just plot this.
I'm looking at a graph labor economist Heidi Shierholz just pulled up in her office at the Economic Policy Institute. It's a Washington think tank. She's not a big fan of the media hype around the release of the unemployment rate every month because she feels like it doesn't tell the whole story.
If the unemployment rate is improving, that's really only good news if we see a bigger share of the labor force that's working.
The unemployment rate leaves out a lot of people, people who have stopped looking for jobs. In economist speak, they've dropped out of the labor force.
So when people who may have otherwise been unemployed drop out of the labor force, that makes the unemployment rate look better.
People out there like Valerie Young.
It's been almost 3 years now and I haven't found anything.
So she stopped looking. Young has four kids and a husband who's on disability. They live just outside Salt Lake City. Young left college early to get married and raise a family. When her husband got sick, she had to jump into the workforce quick. Except,
even though I have put in hundreds of applications and dozens of resumes, I've been told by a lot of employers in interviews that they are looking for someone with more education with a college degree.
So she's taken out a loan to go back to college. She starts next week. People like Young who don't have college degrees have dropped out of the labor force in a larger proportion than people who do have college degrees. Sean Smith wants to go back to college too. He's moved to three states in as many years looking for work. Nothing stuck. In the 90s, he was making such good money doing landscaping, he dropped out of school to work full time. Now he lives with his parents in Largo, Florida.
Being 31 years old, wanting to go back to school, you know, just because you want to stop and do that doesn't mean that life's going to stop. You know, your bills are still going to come in, so it would have to be something. Ugh, clocks.
Is that like one of your parents' old clocks or something?
My mom got it for 25 years with her company, and so that she hung it up.
Do you think you'll ever get a clock like that?
I would like to think I could, but I don't think that's something that will happen.
Before the recession in 2007, people who had some college but didn't have a bachelor's, about 70% of them were working. When the recession hit, that number dropped to about 65%, and it keeps dropping. Economist Heidi Shierholz picks it up from here.
And when jobs do become available, when there are literally millions of very desperate people out there, workers with higher education credentials can sort of go down the ladder. They can take jobs that are below their skills and experience, and workers with lower education credentials can fall off the bottom.
If you can't even get on the ladder, how will you start to climb it? Zoe Chace, NPR News.
You're listening to NPR News.
All right, the moment of truth. We've had 4,000 stories that came in for round six of 3-Minute Fiction, and we have a winner. And here with me to help out is novelist and our judge this round, round six of 3-Minute Fiction on Weekends and All Things Considered, Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. Chimamanda, hello.
Hello, Guy.
So the challenge that you set out for this round was to have one character tell a joke and one character cry. What did the writers do with that challenge?
It was interesting. Lots of animals featured in many of the stories. and also some people were able to make the crying not be about sorrow, if that makes sense, which I found interesting. So I've just really enjoyed reading them.
So Chimamanda, who's a winner?
Am I allowed to take a little longer so people just get a bit more frustrated? All right, so the winning story is a story called A Saint and a Criminal, and it's by Laurie Anderson of Lubbock, Texas.
I love that story because that was actually a finalist that you picked earlier. We have Susan Stamberg, and she is going to read the entire story for us right now. Let's take a listen, and then we'll call up Laurie Anderson.
My father tells a joke about a saint and a criminal who meet at a bar. He forgets the punchline, but I get his meaning. I am supposed to be one, my brother the other. Until yesterday, I might have known which one I am, but now I could be either. Yesterday, the trick was, don't tell your brother about his wife, the one he's been married to for less than a year, the one he loves but sometimes hurts. Do not tell your brother that she is pregnant with some other man's child, that you have seen her yourself at the mall, and she is already doing the kind of walk that is more like a waddle. My father is certain this information can do no good, not when my brother is finally eating again. Not when he has finally been matriculated back into the general population. He is right, my father, I know this, but somehow this knowledge, it perches on the edge of my tongue like a tiny bird trying to flap its wings. I cough, I try to swallow, I vow to stay silent, but I keep thinking about all the times my brother came home late or not at all, my father's brow stitched with worry, my mother crying in the bathroom where she thought I couldn't hear. I think of that night, the late ringing phone, the three of us shuffling about in the dark, the coat I put on inside out. All those lights made the unfamiliar street seem almost foreign, the reds and blues casting everyone as garish characters, puppets in a show. By the time we arrived, the ambulance had already carried the woman away. We surveyed the damage, my father running his hands through his hair, my mother shredding a Kleenex into shaggy bits that rested on the grass at her feet. Before us, my brother's squatty Chrysler sat in the middle of someone else's living room, the hole in the exterior wall like a mouth full of jagged teeth. The television, upside down in the fireplace, spun gray static from its screen. I wanted to know, did he hear the woman screaming? Or did he find her after, pinned by the bumper, a last spasm of the hand, a final word, and then nothing? I looked for him, and finally found him in the back of a cruiser, his head ducked low. I could have called to him, I guess, let him know we were there, but instead, I watched him across the crowded driveway, both of us bathed in strange light, while my father talked with the officer in charge, and my mother sobbed into the back of her hand. Yesterday, at visiting hours, my brother looks a little bit more like himself. He is laughing, no longer sullen, no longer afraid to look us in the eye. He seems hopeful, even. His first opportunity for parole in just 6 months, a new cell assignment. He's even made a friend. What kind of a person wants someone she loves to pay and keep paying? What kind of person tallies in her mind every harm done her? I sit on my hands. I avoid his eyes. But there is no escaping the new quality of his voice. If I didn't know better, I would think he was the same man, the same as before the accident, the same brother I have always known. The tiny bird on my tongue is raising its wings. The feathers tickle my throat. I cough. I open my mouth.
That story is A Saint and a Criminal by Laurie Anderson of Lubbock, Texas. And Laurie Anderson is with us right now. Laurie, congratulations.
Oh, thank you so much.
And meet Chimamanda. Chimamanda, Laurie, Chimamanda.
Hello. Hello, Laurie. Congratulations to you.
Thank you.
Chimamanda, first, before I ask Laurie a bunch of questions, can you tell us what it was about this story that distinguished it? Why did you pick this one?
When I started to read this, there was sort of an immediate sense of a writer who was sure. Mm. And I found that the writing quite beautiful. I thought that it was well done in the way that things were left unsaid. But the unsaidness of these things propelled the story and kept the interest of the reader. And also I thought the characters were very richly drawn.
Laurie, what do you do out there in Lubbock?
I'm a graduate student, actually, at Texas Tech University in creative writing.
Can I ask Laurie a question about the story?
Of course.
I'm just sort of curious about how the story came about and whether this is this part of something larger, or did you actually just write this for the 3-minute fiction contest?
I sort of had these ideas kind of tumbling around in my head, but I didn't exactly know what form they would take. And then I saw the contest, and I thought, well, maybe it can work as a really short story, because really all I had was just a series, you know, a handful of scenes. Mm-hmm. So I guess it worked out.
Yeah, it worked very well.
It did indeed. How would you describe this story?
I think it's about two people who are in these prescribed roles, and they don't exactly know how to get out of them. And as much as she wants to be the better person here, I don't know if she can.
I was wondering, Laurie, why you chose to end it the way you did, because it's kind of an open-ended ending, right?
Right.
You kind of like leave us hanging there.
You know, I ended it that way, sort of on the verge of something, because that's a little bit more interesting to me, I guess. The moment before the decision is made seems sort of rife with complication and emotion in a way that maybe the climactic moment isn't.
Laurie, Chimamanda, as you know, is an accomplished short story writer. Did you have any questions for Chimamanda? Any advice or things that you maybe wanted to ask her?
Yeah. I'm always curious about a writer's process and where they write and how long they write each day. I think as a beginning writer, I'm still trying to figure those things out.
You know, I very often get asked about my process, and I'm always tempted to invent a story about how I have to light red candles and, you know, meditate for 15 minutes and do some yoga, right? But I really don't have a set process. I do try every day to make out time to touch base with my work. So sometimes I'll read something I've done before, I will edit something that I've done. And I often say that every day I must give at least half an hour to my work.
Laurie, are you going to celebrate tonight? Bottle of champagne?
Yeah. I mean, as a graduate student, we don't make a whole lot of money. So a nice dinner would be a good celebration for sure.
That's Laurie Anderson. She's the winner of round 6 of our 3-minute fiction contest here on Weekends and All Things Considered. Her story is called A Saint and a Criminal. You've also been hearing from Chimamanda Ngozi Adichie. She's the author of The Thing Around Your Neck and Half of a Yellow Sun. She was our judge this round. You can read Laurie's story and those of other contenders and finalists at our series page. It's npr.org/3-minute-fiction. Laurie, thank you so much, and congratulations to you.
Thank you very much.
And, of course, Chimamanda, I'm going to miss you, and I hope when you're going to come down to Washington, D.C. from Baltimore to see us.
I will. I certainly will, Guy, just to see you.
And we're going to be taking a short break from 3-Minute Fiction. Stay tuned for announcements about Round 7. We hope to launch that early in the summer.
And another announcement at the top of the program. We mentioned that guy was on special assignment today. Well, he was in a delivery room. Abraham Leo Roz was born today. A big congrats to Guy, Mom Hannah, Big Brother Henry, from everyone here. For Sunday, that's All Things Considered from NPR News. I'm Jackie Leiden.